The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to WVUD's Campus Voices, weekly conversations with interesting members of the university community, visitors to campus, and others engaged in thought-provoking research and community service. Stay tuned for Campus Voices on WVUD.
Welcome to Campus Voices. This is Rachel Silva with Julia Giambastiani. We're here with Steve Hegedus, Senior Scientist at Institute of Energy Conversion at the University of Delaware, and Bill Schafferman, the Interim Director of IEC.
So Bill, why don't you tell us a little bit about the IEC and how it came to be?
So IEC has been a research institute at the University of Delaware since 1972. That makes us the longest operating solar research center in the world. Something we're pretty proud of. So we were founded in 1972 to look at new ways to make solar cells, new materials, new processes, and we've been doing that in one way or another ever since. Obviously, with various, a lot of people have come and gone. Neither of us has been here since 1972, although we've both been here a long time.
So how did you come to get involved with the IEC here at University of Delaware?
So when I finished graduate school, I studied physics in graduate school, and I was looking for some way to apply my education in a way that, had some broader societal impact, at the same time being some sort of exciting physics of materials and processes, and this was a perfect match. So I applied for and was fortunate enough to get a job here, and I've been here ever since.
So what is your specific area of research?
So my focus has primarily been on a material, I'll call it CIGS, which is copper indium gallium diselenide. And this is a material that is uniquely interesting and works in unique ways specifically for solar cells. The focus of most of our research in one way or another is using what we call thin films. So these are materials that are deposited in very thin layers, typically a size scale of about 1 micron, which is 1 millionth of a meter. And for reference, a typical hair is about 40 or 50 microns, so very thin layers. And the key is developing the materials that can work with those thin layers, and developing the ways to make solar cells out of them and to develop the processes, so integrating all those things. So with the CIGS I mentioned, we're doing all aspects of all of those pieces of the puzzle to make this a successful commercial product.
How would you say this would benefit our community here in Delaware, but also our community in the world?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that solar energy is a technology that provides lots of benefits, most importantly mitigating the burning of fossil fuels, which has a lot of obvious negatives in terms of climate change, most obviously, but also pollution and other effects, and the way we dig coal out of the ground and get oil and other fossil fuels out of the ground is destructive. So solar energy has obvious benefits in terms of being clean and renewable and sustainable, and hopefully we're getting closer and closer. In many cases, we've passed the point where it's cost effective. And so globally, I think it's pretty obvious the benefits of solar cells. In terms of locally here in Delaware and at the University of Delaware, we, at the Institute here, we have a long record of educating students, training students who are going out and working at companies all over the world to develop this, training students to do research in new materials, to do manufacturing, to implement it. So I think all those things are beneficial, and all those things, integrate with other stuff going on here at the University of Delaware. And I am also a professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering, And the main reason that that's valuable to me and to the Institute is that a big part of our mission here is training graduate students. So that allows me to work directly and bring in students from material science, also from other departments, physics, for example, in my case. So the training of students, they do a lot of the research, and they make the and for me, they make the research and the work day to day really still fun and exciting, because they come in with lots of energy and good questions, and that's a lot of what makes it a great job.
So in training these graduate students, do you really try to instill in them the idea that you can help the environment in the long term, or is it more short-term focus?
I think most of the students that come here and are successful here come to Delaware with the idea that they want to have a bigger impact on the world and want to study solar energy. So they're already eager to get into this field. And so I don't need to excite them about that. They come here with that. So on a day-to-day basis, it's more about teaching them to do research and to, and you know, the experimental procedures and data analysis and the fundamentals behind it.
How do you feel the new administration is going to affect a lot of your initiatives here?
Well, obviously, you know, the new administration has talked a lot about that they're not interested or not believing in climate change, and they're also very interested in shrinking government. So the combination of those two things puts a real danger that funding for research in things like solar energy is going to be drastically cut. We're hopeful that there's enough momentum that maybe it won't be so drastic, but it could have a big impact on us here at IEC, because our funding is, a lot of it is funded by research grants from the U.S. government.
What is it important for the layperson to know about what you guys are working on here?
I think, first off, you know, I hope there's a broad appreciation at Delaware of the kinds of research that are being done in things that are really relevant to our world. And so the more they know that the work here at IEC, as in many other research groups at the university, you know, are really, really exciting and trying to have an impact. I think specifically, you know, most people are surprised. They don't know much about IEC, and they're surprised when they hear that we've got this world-renowned institute here, right here in Delaware, studying solar energy. It's nice to be recognized.
So, Steve, I know we heard a lot about what Bill does here at the IEC. Can you tell us a little bit about your role here?
I have worked on a wide range of different solar technologies here at the Institute, primarily from the point of view of characterizing them, measuring them, figuring out how to make them more efficient, to make more energy. And the number of different technologies that the Institute works on has been pretty impressive. There's very few other organizations that have worked on the, you know, entire range of technologies that have been commercially viable. We really focus on those technologies that are transitioning or have good promise to transition to commercialization, not things that are really far out and, you know, esoteric. So that's sort of one of our missions, is to help the industry grow and to transition ideas and concepts from the laboratory into manufacturing. So I've worked on that with a couple of different technologies, different from the ones that you know Bill's worked on. Right now, my main emphasis is on a project to develop a type of solar cell that's been around for a while, but we've sort of been proponents of merging the two best ideas for crystalline silicon wafer cells. Those are the dominant ones that you see on people rooftop, those blue squares. We had an idea a number of years ago of merging the two best ideas out in the sort of technology marketplace into merging them into one type of cell. And that we were the first ones to do that, but there's been a number of other companies that have done that much better than us recently. And in fact, the world's record Solar Cell uses those two concepts and has merged them. So we're trying to come up with a way of making it a little bit lower cost and more manufacturable using lasers to pattern the metal contacts.
What do you think the timeline is for solar energy to be cost competitive with traditional energy sources? Do you predict it to be soon coming or far out into the future?
5 years ago. The answer is it depends on a whole bunch of things. It depends on where you are location-wise. It depends on what time of day it is. Solar is competitive at some times of day when the price of electricity is higher in some places. In the island of Hawaii, solar was competitive several years ago because their price of energy is much higher. It also depends on what sort of incentives are available at the state or federal level. And it also depends on what you're trying to accomplish. And this is where one of the most, I think, the most breakthrough or transformational aspects of solar comes into play. Our entire utility grid system was based on the concept of big centralized power plants, coal burning, nuclear or natural gas power plants at a very large scale, let's say at the, you know, what's called a gigawatt, thousands of megawatts scale of power, and radiating that power out on transmission lines and then distribution lines to consumers, to residents, to businesses. And that worked for a while, but what solar really allows you to do is what's called distributed generation, where instead of having one big central power plant, you have power plants on every rooftop, in every neighborhood, on every parking lot. And so now you're spreading out the generation, making it more localized, and so you're reducing a lot of the transmission losses. You're also changing the whole economics of the way that the electric system works, because now you have homeowners, investors, businesses participating in the buying and selling of electricity. And with the technology that is, you know, presently available in terms of batteries and inverters, you can decide, for example, whether you want to save the energy that you're making right now in your batteries and use it later, or let it flow out onto the grid and get credit for it and let your neighbors use it. So that changes the whole dynamic of the relation between the customer and the utility. And solar is really one of the only technologies that lets you do this on that scale. You can't do this with wind. You know, you can't have everybody putting up wind towers in their backyards. You can't do this with natural gas, for example. So solar really is transformational in that way. And so, you know, when you ask your original question about how is it cost effective, it really does depend on what you're trying to accomplish. And right now, people are, you know, a lot of the forecasters are saying that, you know, in certain parts of the country, solar is already cost effective. It will probably become cost effective in a significant amount, a significant part of the United States by, you know, 2020 or 2022.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Sunshot Initiative, the project that you're working on?
To keep it sort of simple, the idea is that when the solar wafer is facing the sun, you want to collect as much light as possible. And if you go up and you look close at 99% of the solar modules that are out there, you'll see a very fine pattern of metal grids on it, and that helps to collect the electricity. So a number of years ago, some people had the idea, well, if we could put those metal grids on the back, then we would have more surface for collecting light. So that's been done. It's been well established. There's a company in the U.S. that's been doing that for a number of years, making the highest efficiency modules on the market. But it's a little bit more expensive to do that because you have to do more processing steps. And so what we're trying to do is, like I said, to use lasers and different ways of applying the metal contacts to the back of the solar cell to make this process faster and lower cost.
So, Steve, I'm aware that you have multiple degrees in electrical engineering. How did you come about going into the solar energy path mm-hmm. rather than a different career choice?
Oh, that's, yeah. When I was an undergraduate in the early 1970s at Case Western Reserve University, the very second month that I was in school, a major international event occurred called the Arab oil embargo, and it was where the Saudi government decided to restrict the flow of oil by only about 10 or 15%, but it caused major disruptions in prices, and all of a sudden the whole world became aware that, wow, energy is limited. We better think about this. And so all of a sudden engineering and technology disciplines were looking at other forms of energy, and solar was one that was certainly looked at. I had a professor who was sort of a strange guy, but he was very interested in solar and had worked on solar before it was even popular. And so I somehow hooked up with him and got working on a project he had in the basement of the building, and we built some solar hot water collectors. And that just got me hooked. And I took a class on energy policy, and the book that we used had a picture on the back of a very funny looking building with a very steeply sloped roof. What I didn't realize at the time was that was the University of Delaware Solar One house, and that 20 years later I would spend a good bit of time in the basement of that house rewiring it and connecting it to do some different solar things. It's right on the corner of Wyoming Road and Chapel Street. So it's now used by the ambulance services emergency crew. So I got really interested in solar, and there was a lot of interest, there was a lot of funding, a lot of companies started up. So I went to work for IBM because they offered me a job. But the whole time I was there, I was still interested in solar. So finally, after several years, I said, I got to make this transition. And I sent out about 20 or 30 applications to all these different companies. But unfortunately, my timing was terrible because President Reagan had just taken office and almost eliminated the entire renewable energy budget, cut it by 90%. And within months, many, many of the companies just disappeared. I was very fortunate that this place took a chance on me. And I've been here for over 40 years. No, I'm sorry, over 35 years, yes.
And to continue off of Julia's earlier question, how do you think this new administration will affect your work here at the IEC?
Well, it's not going to be good, that's for sure, but it may not be as bad as everyone is suspecting. But it could be, actually. We just don't know. The one big difference between now and what I was describing before, where government policy dramatically changed the landscape, is that in 1980s, the industry was very, very small, very dependent on government support, and there were a lot of new ideas that needed to be supported so they could make that transition from a research lab into manufacturing. What's really different now is that this is a very big and a much more mature industry. It has a lot of momentum. There's a lot of international players. And the, you know, employment picture is so different now, where you have, for example, more people installing solar modules last year than were digging coal. So solar is a big business. And in fact, two out of every 100 jobs last year were created in the solar industry in the U.S. So worldwide, there's a lot of interest, not just in manufacturing, but in deployment and installation. So there's a lot that will continue regardless of what happens in Washington. It will happen slower, but very definitely some of the policies that are being talked about, in fact, just came out in the last couple of days, would significantly impact the funding that we get here at the Institute. So it could be bad, but there's already some congressional organization to oppose that.
If I could, that, yeah, I could absolutely add to what Steve was saying about. So another of the unique things about IEC is that we have a long history of collaborating with industry and having international collaborations. So Steve talked about how, you know, it's a much broader world, the solar energy world right now. And we, in many ways, I think, are well positioned to take advantage of that because we do work with various companies. We've worked with dozens of companies over the years, big companies, small companies, local, American, international. And so that gives us an opportunity to reach out beyond any potential limitations to government funding. And it also is valuable because it makes us constantly aware of what is important to manufacturing and understanding what the critical issues are rather than just sitting in our laboratories guessing what makes sense for manufacturing.
And this is a question for either of you. How well does the average American understand the concept of solar energy? Do you think that, you know, it's something that a lot of people are looking into, or do you think they need more incentive to pursue that?
When they break down the cost of installing a solar system, there's hardware, you know, there's the modules, there's the wiring, there's the device that converts the electricity so that it can be connected to the grid, called an inverter. Then there's installation costs, you know, labor. But one of the biggest costs is what's called customer acquisition, namely going out there, generating a sale, educating them, and closing the deal, and filling out the paperwork, and getting the permits, and all that sort of thing. The customer acquisition part could be a lot easier if people had a better understanding of the energy system in general and what solar energy could do and how, when we say how it works, we don't mean on the, you know, atomic microscopic level, but just how the energy generation and control system works. That would make the seller's job a little bit easier.
So I'll pose to you the same question I asked Bill. What do you think is most important for the layperson to know about solar energy?
That it is a large and well-established industry, that the number of players they're getting smaller because it's coalescing, which is what a mature industry does. The technologies have been shown, you know, it's well-known, well-established. They last a long time. Lifetimes are over 25 years. They're very reliable. And way in which they're installed now, you know, people have gotten that down pretty well. And there is not a lot of risk at all in doing it. And the way in which we can move forward would be to promote more solar energy, which is what we're all about, is to keep looking for new applications and making sure that people realize this isn't some, you know, experimental weird thing. We no longer call solar energy alternative energy. It's not alternative. And, you know, one example of that is that for the last several years, when you look at new generating capacity, new plants that are being built in the U.S., solar and wind are the largest two factors there. It's not coal and nuclear. So they are the new growth energy technologies.
Adding to, Rachel, your question about what people should understand about solar, I think it's important to get out and talk about it because there are a lot of misconceptions. And a couple of examples of that are one that people get confused about what solar is because they know about solar for hot water and solar for electricity. That's a common misconception. What we're talking about today and what the Institute has focused on is solar electricity. So these are devices that just sitting out in the sunlight, they generate electricity. Solar hot water is also great technology, but much more limited in its applicability. Another misconception that I hear from a lot of people is that, well, it can't work very well in Delaware because it's cloudy all the time or we're too far north. And, you know, maybe it works in Arizona, but it can't work in Delaware. And the truth to that is that the total amount of sunlight difference between Arizona and Delaware, I think this is about 20%, I think, total.
25.
So 25%. So it's not a big difference. And a more important thing to keep in mind or to compare is that Germany, through very aggressive policies, has by far the most solar that they've installed and mixed into their electric grid. And we have far more sunlight than they do in Germany because they're further north, quite honestly, and cloudier. So these differences due to where you are relatively minor in the scheme. It does play into a little bit the specific economics of when it's cost effective. But solar works great in Delaware, and it works great almost everywhere, and that shouldn't be a limitation.
In fact, my class that I teach, we just finished a homework assignment where that is sort of the main theme. I have the students compare a solar installation in Phoenix, Arizona, Wilmington, and Minneapolis. And the surprising thing is that Wilmington and Minneapolis generate almost exactly the same amount of energy per year, no matter how it's installed, whether it's not moving or whether it's tracking the sun or... And also, when you take into account some other weather-related things, we actually have a little bit more of an advantage than Phoenix. So the difference between Wilmington and Phoenix in terms of generating energy is only about 20% after you take everything into account. So it does work everywhere. And the other point I want to make is that if somebody wants to use solar, one of the best ways of using solar energy is to go to the hardware store, buy a clothesline and some clothespins, and hang out your wash. I've been doing that for 40 years, and it feels great. I know I'm using solar energy.
Do you guys use solar energy in your own homes?
I have. I was the first resident of Newark to have a solar system installed on my house, and that was 10 years ago.
All right, great. Thank you so much for meeting with us today, Steve, Bill. It's been great talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official views of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archived episodes, visit our website, www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.